thank you for having me. It's really good to be here. And it's you know, as I was telling Colin and MR, I think I'm neither a law person nor am I a tech person. So I'm trained as a rhetorician, and which means that I'm interested in, I guess, the ways in which some of these issues intersect around language and how the language that we use and the arguments that we develop and the metaphors that we use to develop those arguments, how they really can affect and limit and open up possibilities for social movements and so on. So I'm going to be talking specifically about the book Our Space, but primarily about the last case study that I engage in the book, and that is about Creative Commons, which, as you know, was founded here, and I'm sure some of you are still involved. And so, again, as far as issues of intellectual property and so on, I know that I'm in a room full of people that probably know more about these issues than I do. So I'll look forward to your thoughts and comments, and hope that the added value that I bring to the table is some thoughts about the language that we use and so on. So the central task of the book is, just to give you a little bit of background on that, to kind of tee up what I want to talk about, which is the last argument in the book. But the central task of the book is to investigate the constitution and inventional possibilities of publics in an age dominated by the rhetoric and logics of the market. That is, how are publics made and what can they do? In the book, I examine how social movements like culture jamming seek to undermine the rhetoric of multinational corporations, specifically through practices such as media pranking. And some of the examples that I look at in the book is the work of a group out of San Francisco called the Biotic Baking Brigade. If you're not familiar with them, their mission to pie pompous people. Here is, they've pied Bill Gates. Here they pied Milton Friedman. And I talk about, at some length, media pranking as a strategy in other chapters of the book. And sort of good old-fashioned ad busting, which you're probably familiar with the work of Adbusters magazine. This is kind of a play on this campaign that The Gap ran in the late 90s, which was, you know, different countercultural figures wearing khakis to kind of position khakis as, you know, sort of the rugged individualist pant choice. And of course, yeah, so this obviously turns it into sort of mass conformity writ large. So ad busting, things like billboard liberation, right? People like the Billboard Liberation Front who go out in the middle of the night and do some things as sophisticated as actually rerouting neon and turning off parts of signs and so on. Sometimes it's just sophisticated computer graphics that alter existing advertising messages and so on. Or copyright and trademark infringement, and you're probably familiar with a lot of that work. People that are just trying to steal, hijack, you know, corporate imagery in order to either comment on the kind of litigiousness of corporate culture around their brands and their brand imagery, or just to make a case for public domain in general. I'll talk a little bit more about some of that. But among the questions that the project raises is whether so-called resistance, as traditionally conceived, has reached its limit as a diagnostic category for critics interrogating struggles over cultural messages in the global economy. So in the book, I provide a taxonomy of contemporary anti-corporate activism that I break down in the following way. And first are activists engaging in what I talk about as sabotage. And that's an explicitly dialectic repudiation of the rhetoric of consumer culture. It's a strategy that begins from the premise that we have become merely consuming publics, which is the original title of the book, by the way, that we've become merely consuming publics, publics who consume. Sabotage is a direct attempt to thwart what activists see as the repressive disciplinarity of the spectacle and to wake the citizenry from their stupor. So it's a very kind of wake up, shake the masses and to sort of bring them to reality in some way. The rhetoric of sabotage is probably best exemplified by Adbusters magazine, and I look at them at some length in the book, and their approach to commercialization as a monolithic machine or image factory that must be stopped or slowed down. So this is culture jamming in a very oppositional way. In fact, in their Culture Jammers manifesto that they publish in Adbusters and also in their founder, Callie Lassen, has a book called Culture Jam.
Their Culture Jammers manifesto says, we're going to bring the imagery to a shuddering, the image factory to a shuddering halt. And I talk about that it's very telling that they use this very industrial revolution factory metaphor as a way of talking about the enemy. And in fact, they talk about themselves as contemporary saboteurs, and they use the language of sabotage quite a bit. Sabotage, for those of you that may not know, etymologically comes from the word sabot, which means wooden clogs. And during the Industrial Revolution, when workers wanted to literally stop the machine of industry, they would throw their clogs, where we also get the metaphor to clog, they would throw their clogs into the machinery, into the factory machine, in order to stop work for the day, and as a means of protest. Part of what I suggest in the book is that although sabotage has its time and place, and it certainly had its time and place in the face of industrial capitalism and sometimes today in certain parts of the world, I challenge the notion that we can really look at today's consumer culture and today's sort of swirling, scintillating barrage of images as a factory. I wonder about the limitations of that very 20th century or 19th century metaphor for how capitalism functions. Secondly, I examine culture jamming strategies that rather than sabotaging commercial culture, attempt to appropriate it toward new ends. So through practices of pranking, like I showed you the pies in the face, and I look at a variety of sort of people who commit pranks in order to get themselves on television and so on, and also copyright pirates I put in this group. These appropriation artists attempt to take seriously consumer culture on its own terms and engage it accordingly. So it's less oppositional and more sort of taking advantage of some of the resources that commercial culture provides. However, I suggest that appropriation artists, in their celebration of the criminal artist, do tend to perpetuate, although less so maybe than saboteurs, a dialectical or oppositional relationship with commercial culture. By positioning themselves as outlaws, I argue that appropriation artists risk validating the very codes they challenge. This strategy begins from another premise, that the dictates of markets have so successfully turned us into mere consumers that the only response is the citizen as criminal. That is, post-industrial capitalism, with its tendency to turn products into brands and brands into the vernacular of everyday life, has consumed publics. So markets are consuming publics rather than just turning us into consumers. Publics, in that sense, are being consumed. So I conclude the book, and this is what I want to talk about today, I conclude the book by looking at a third set of responses to commercial culture, responses that do not so much attempt to thwart brand giants nor liberate small pieces of culture from their clutches. Rather, by actively promoting the concept of the commons, these activists augment and intensify certain aspects of markets. So importantly, the strategy is unavailable to those who see markets and publics as mutually exclusive. Rather than saying no to consumer culture as the antithesis of healthy, thriving publics, an intensification strategy says yes and to the tools that markets afford. This strategy begins from the premise that publics are everywhere, that they are all consuming. It is this third strategy that I want to discuss today, and it comes from the final chapter of the book, which is Inventing Publics, Kairos and Intellectual Property Law. So, just a bit about some of and contemporary theories on sort of the notion of how publics function. One of the more popular in the recent studies of publics and publicness has been Michael Warner's Publics and Counterpublics. In Warner's model, publics do not exist a priori their textual interpolation before they are called into being by the rhetorics that speak them. As such, publics are kinds of fictions, albeit fictions with identifiable properties and very real material effects. Publics, as Warner begins his book, are queer creatures. You cannot point to them, count them, or look them in the eye. You also cannot easily avoid them. They have become an almost natural feature of the social landscape, like pavement. However, as even a cursory read of his argument illustrates, Warner's publics are really nothing like pavement. They are shaped by the temporality of circulation, those are his terms, an ebb and flow of discourses demanding our attention and building on one another. Their rhythms are shaped and punctuated by an endless systolic and diastolic pulsing of newspapers, Hollywood films, 24-hour news channels, sitcoms, movies of the week, etc., etc. The texts of our everyday lives that constitute the teeming and multi-citational field in which publics are made. So for Warner, I think he really foregrounds this notion that publics are created through the circulation of texts. So questions of intellectual property law and how is it that texts circulate have a direct effect on what we can understand as public. What does invention, which is a primary concern for rhetoricians like myself, or creativity, maybe put more plainly, invention of a foundation of rhetoric, what does it look like in such a model? How can publics thrive and create under these conditions? One response, a very common response, one that I'd like to resist, would be to begin from the premise insisted upon by people like Jürgen Habermas that the public flourishes in the absence of control, that healthy publics enjoy absolute freedom from, say, governmental or commercial constraints. Warner's metaphors such as circulation and dissemination might indeed lend themselves to the position that the circulation of texts that constitute publics must be protected from rules or obstructions of any kind. So in my analysis, I look at, I'll kind of speed through some of this kind of public theory stuff. One of the concerns is that certainly that intellectual property law is acting as a tourniquet. It's choking off the circulation of texts on which publics depend, right? That if publics completely depend on the free circulation of texts, then there's this concern that intellectual property law, copyright regimes and so on are kind of acting as a tourniquet. So for many, at the heart of the debate is our freedom of speech and our capacity to create new and innovative works. And at stake for many of those involved, of course, is the conditions for creativity itself. So some who might agree with the notion that publics depend upon the circulation of texts see the regime of intellectual property law, again, is increasingly threatening this dynamism on which publics thrive, acting as a tourniquet. So my goal is to contribute to the conversation about publics by suggesting that kairos, the Greek concept of kairos, which I'll talk about in a little bit, or a kind of making do, is an inescapable component of text making and indeed public making. This conception encourages, in the case of contemporary intellectual property law, responses that improve on what is rather than mourn a fantasy of what was. I argue that if we look at the strategies of some anti-copyright activists, many of them are fighting for a deregulation of the discursive field, for a lightening of the burden of intellectual property. Their approach correlates to an understanding of publics that would assume that because circulation is what publics require, the appropriate strategy of resistance ought to be to lift regulations that bind them, to decentralize power, and to return to the notion of ideas as common property. Toward this end, many anti-copyright activists act as modern-day Robin Hoods by artistically pirating or hacking copyrighted and trademarked material in an effort to reinvigorate a sense of the commons. As I argue, then, the copyright pirate model of resistance, despite its good intentions, perpetuates and solidifies the most harmful assumption girding current intellectual property law, that is, that intellectual materials can and should be exclusively treated as property. As an alternative to the notion that ideas and concepts are property, I suggest that the most compelling approach comes from the so-called free culture or creative commons movement. Unlike other copyright activists, those who ostentatiously pirate corporate intellectual property in an effort to make a case for deregulation, the creative commons sharing model embraces a thoughtful and detailed increase in regulations, agreements that emerge in specific and ever-changing encounters between texts, the law, and publics. Ultimately, I argue, perhaps controversially, that a conception of rhetorical invention based on the classical Greek ideal of kairos rather than property offers a way of reimagining the public as being made more robust, not less, by regulations, albeit regulations of a different kind. Kairos, in the sense that I want to propose it here, is a rhetorical art for which, in Carolyn Miller's words, quote, the challenge is to invent within a set of unfolding and unprecedented circumstances an action, rhetorical or otherwise, that will be understood as uniquely meaningful within those circumstances. And I'll talk about it a little bit more. Now, again, I don't want to rehearse issues that people are well familiar with, so I'll just maybe abbreviate here a little bit. But part of what I suggest in the book, again, which is for a more general audience than what I have here, is talking about, you know, the notion that ideas don't operate based on notions of scarcity and so on, which a lot of anti-copyright activists and others readily say, right? And they often quote Jefferson as his metaphor about sort of, if I light your candle with mine, it's, you know, mine isn't darkened, and so on. People use those metaphors. But at the same time, there continues to be a lot of rhetoric, such as John Oswald's notion that if creativity is a field, trademark is the fence, which is an oft-quoted, as you probably know, comment about the influence of intellectual property on creativity. I'll talk about that in a minute, right? So there's this great resistance to this notion of trademark as being the fence, presumably, that cordons off creativity and so on. So, of course, in response, a number of scholars and activists and so on have advanced then this metaphor, maybe the metaphor isn't even the right way of putting it, this notion of the commons, right, kind of echoing Habermas's fears about the monopolizing tendencies of private enterprise. Communication scholar Kembry McLeod, for example, wonders in his book Owning Culture, in this environment, how in the world are people supposed to critique the ubiquitous privately owned texts that help shape our consciousness without being able to reproduce them? So a growing number of so-called appropriation artists are responding by invoking a kind of pirate ethic, as I've mentioned before. By unabashedly using copyrighted and trademark material in their own work, they attempt to call attention to the asymmetrical control over our cultural materials. In doing so, many activists have sometimes unwittingly provoked major corporations into high-profile legal battles, which directly affect the future shape of what counts as the public domain. So illustrating this kind of art of theft, those who pirate and hijack own materials attempt to free information and so on from what they see as the prison of private ownership. And a couple examples of well-known cases, this is the Food Chain Barbie series by Tom Forsythe. And this is probably a familiar case for some people. The artist, Starbucks took him to court, realized that they didn't have a case based on copyright because this was considered fair use, it's political commentary and so on, but they kind of did an end run and got him on trademark dilution, which is increasingly, as some of you probably know, used by corporations against political commentators when I think that it's meant to be a protection against other corporate marketers and so on, competitors. So a concern for the commons is a concern that the texts that create publics are being strangled again by the control of copyright. So part of, again, this is kind of a couple chapters that I go over sort of the notion of appropriation by both pranksters and pirates. But part of the critique that I have as productive and sometimes appropriate these kinds of strategies are, again, as somebody who studies rhetoric, my position is always that that you need to pick a strategy based on the situation in which you find yourself. So no strategy is universally good, nor no strategy is universally bad. But one of the limitations that I think that appropriation art has in the face of its perceived enemy is that I want to suggest that the restrictions posed by intellectual property are more prohibitive if we accept the notion that intellectual material can only be imagined as property. And I worry that the appropriation artist strategy of stealing copyright material, so-called stealing, as an act of subversion is too limited. That is, if we perpetuate romantic notions of anti-copyright activists as pirates or Robin Hoods stealing from monolithic corporate landlords, we leave uninterrogated the founding premise that ideas are property that can be hoarded or denied. The most crucial argumentative terrain is ceded from the start. That is, I say in the book that it's like stealing bits and pieces from the kingdom while leaving the monarchy intact. So I'm going to sort of leave that because I think that hopefully that critique is clear. But together with the notion, Oswald's notion that trademark is the fence in creativity, in a field of creativity, likewise, David Bollier's position serves as another example of this kind of call for, again, the lifting of restrictions. He says, quote, "Any sort of creative endeavor, which is to say progress, requires an open white space in which experimentation and new construction can take place. There must be the freedom to try new things." So in his book Silent Theft, he describes a monolithic corporate takeover of our commonly shared resources that diminishes the variability to progress as a culture. He idealizes an open, decentralized terrain for civic invention that is unsullied by the interests of private enterprise. As he says, quote, an argument for the commons, then, is an argument for more white space. So part of, if I could just kind of, I guess, get to the nub of where I come down on this, rehearse kind of how Creative Commons functions and what its role is and so on. Part of the argument that I make is that this isn't creating more white space. It's not about lifting the fence from a field of creativity. It's in fact an intensification of certain aspects of copyright and so on, right? That it's a layered, added layer of augmentation or an added layer of nuance that in fact can increase the circulation of texts rather than decrease them, which is often the fear. And I go about this through, among other things, the concept of kairos. Let me talk just a little bit about that so that you know where I'm coming from. So if we allow a notion of publics that recognizes that circulation is not necessarily the dialectical opposite of regulation, again, so it's not just about lifting regulation. I think the Creative Commons case sort of shows that that an added level of regulation can actually speed up and free up texts, then we remain open to the ways in which the intensification of regulatory categories can actually increase the circulation and vitality of creative publics. So in the book, I propose that for those interested in promoting a robust and democratic commons, the ancient rhetorical concept of kairos serves as a more appropriate rhetorical resource than property. In the Golden Age of Greece, Philip Seporia tells us, kairos was, quote, typically thought of as timing or the right time, although its use went far beyond temporal reference. So unlike chronos or chronos, which was associated with a linear quantitative time, kairos was better understood as a moment of a particular quality. The word carried a number of meanings, including symmetry, propriety, occasion, due measure, fitness, tact, decorum, convenience, proportion, profit, and wise moderation. So it's all about sort of, it's a meaning about taking advantage of the particular moment in which one finds themselves. And I go to some lengths in the book in my analysis of Creative Commons that the fact that you can tailor licenses and agreements based on each text and based on each instance allows for kairos to thrive, or that it capitalizes on this sort of kairotic moment, so that it's not this blanket zero-sum sort of code that gets a priori mapped onto every transaction. Instead, Creative Commons really makes use of that kind of in the moment, in every sort of specific situation, you to negotiate the rules of the road between creators and users and so on. So I just want to conclude my comments with the strange notion that rhetorical invention may work like a pinball machine. So I encourage us to collaborate on alternatives to models of rhetorical resistance in which publics, I encourage us to collaborate on alternatives to models of rhetorical resistance that move away from the notion in which publics are perpetually on the losing side of an endless cat and mouse game with the corporate establishment. That is, it's probably clear, hopefully, that I'm not willing here to conclude that yes, intellectual property always stifles creativity, right? That's how it works, right? So certainly corporations invoke and even lobby for laws so that they can thwart certain kinds of critique. And it's true that copyright laws were never intended to be used ideologically to silence political dissent. However, as may always be the case, when some kairotic moments are undermined, others are foregrounded. That is, that the current state of intellectual property law is the kairotic moment in which we find ourselves. It provides the conditions from which challenges can emerge. So I offer here the strange supposition that the field of rhetorical invention may be something akin to a pinball machine. I invoke that image because in response to Beaulieu's position that creative progress requires more open space, I want to suggest quite the opposite. Just as a pinball would gather no momentum, no speed, no direction without bumpers and pins to respond to, neither is rhetorical invention possible without constraints and obstacles that define its chirotic encounters. So with this perhaps juvenile example in mind, I would like to return to John Oswald's assertion that trademark is the fence in the field of creativity. Oswald's description is quite useful, although maybe not in the way that he intended. Language is funny that way. Intellectual property is not merely a fence that confines and makes discrete a piece of stagnant property, an impermeable boundary along which powerful corporations successfully post their no trespassing signs. Rather, it is a fence that gives shape and substance to specific fields of discourse. Importantly, fences can be straddled. They can be climbed under, over, and through. They can be extended and reconfigured into playful mazes. They can be walked on like a tightrope. And that ability to walk delicately and precisely in a state of in-between is precisely what defines kairos, perhaps the most crucial component of rhetorical invention. So the mythical figure of kairos was a minor god in the Greek pantheon, and he was depicted as a well-muscled, wing-footed figure perched on a stick or ball, balancing a set of scales on a razor, almost as if walking along a fence. He is also often depicted with winged feet, presumably for those moments when, like a pinball hitting a bumper, he is propelled off in some new and unknown direction. Perhaps the ancient mythical figure of Kairos, like the contemporary mythic figure of the Who's Tommy, knows that creativity is about becoming part of the machine and learning how to play it. So with that, I'll stop the formal talking at you business, and I just kind of wanted to put a question out there, and people can take it and run with it as they want to, or pose other questions, of course. But I guess one of the things that I still try to think about, again, if my interest anyway, is about creating a robust public culture, and how to go about doing that, and how to sort of keep as many and interesting texts in circulation as possible. If what I'm saying is true in that regard, then that circulation of text is central to culture, then what would it take for an open commons to really serve as an alternative to that might actually enjoy a level of circulation that could actually compete with the kind of more hegemonic corporate-owned culture? So in other words, how does something like Creative Commons or the sort of free culture movement more largely and the content that it produces translate, if you think it should at all, and maybe you don't, into the mainstream and not remain this kind of countercultural outlier that's driven by and focuses on a group of people who are interested in specifically these issues. That is it to remain kind of a cultural space where people debate issues of copyright and intellectual property, and people who are concerned about those issues, should that remain the content of the thing, or is there a way for it to kind of translate into people who don't necessarily have an interest in those issues at all, can see the value and take advantage of its resources and so on. So with that, I think I'll just kind of put that out there and see what people think, as well about anything else that people would like to discuss.
Silenced.
Never afraid of.
No. I have a vocabulary point from my field to yours, and a question from your field to mine. I am in the law, inducement intellectual property law, and one of the underlying distinctions of things like copyright is often the idea, at any rate, that there is some sort of separation between the idea and the expression of the idea, and that what is prevented from being used is the expression and not the idea. And in your talk, you repeatedly talk as though you say, you know, copyright law constrains ideas. And you may be using ideas in a somewhat different way, but at least in the very technical way that lawyers think about it, that's just not what it does. The internal notion is that. So I don't know whether you're doing that intentionally or whether you're just are using ideas in a way that would not be the way we would use it. And I would urge you to perhaps at least take that on board.
My
question in return is, and I'm just unacquainted with the field that you're describing, and nice to have my eyes open. What is a public? In this context, you talk about publics and it's just not a term I've got any experience with. So I would appreciate it if you'd
illuminate. No, that's great. I mean, I think that the notion of ideas is, I'm not trying to come down in any way about sort of what ideas are, so much as look at the way that they get talked about, so I'm looking at the ways that activists will talk about. That, you know, that property law is sort of choking off the free flow of ideas, and I think that distinction is an important.
That's actually not what it's doing.
Right.
In theory.
Right.
Maybe.
No, yeah. I think that's an important distinction that I think is absolutely worth making. The notion of what is a public is something that's very much in debate, right? I mean, so for people like Habermas, for example, who coined the term public sphere and is sort of well-known German philosopher on this topic. For him, it's precisely that space that's separate from private enterprise on the one hand and governments on the other. So the public is that thing that keeps at bay. To have a thriving, robust public, you keep at bay both capitalism on the one side and the state on the other. That's not a version of the public that I'm wanting to advance. I think that that you can't separate out publics from markets and publics from, you know, the citizenry and so, or the sort of the government and so on. So for me, publics are groups that kind of hover around centralizing texts, right? So they're communities that hover around certain sets of ideas and so on. But I mean, that, you know, these things are squirrely and debatable. Sure.
So can I see if I understand the question that you posed at the end?
Yeah.
Is it, because it sounded to me, at times it sounded to me as though you were saying, well, can there be an alternative sort of public, alternative mode that is this sort of more Creative Commons mode, this more our space maybe mode? But that to me sounded separate from what we have now, rather than sort of an ecosystem where perhaps the center of gravity is shifted from where it is now, which is the vast majority of all people outside this room are quite content with the status quo, or as far as they know, and that the sort of the commons discussion tends to happen within an elite of some sort or other.
Right.
So was it shifting within? Or would you rephrase it in a way that I didn't understand?
I think what I'm just kind of trying to think this through too, which is why I wanted to pose the question, is that is there a way for some of the values that, say, you know, free culture or a lot of the people in this room probably are committed to, are those sort of destined to be this kind of, you know, rabble rouser from the peanut gallery kind of thing, or is there potential there for it to be a kind of major player in terms of cultural production, and that would involve people who don't necessarily care about issues of free expression and so on, but just see it as a good means to an end for getting their work done or for getting their art done. So I'm just, yeah, that helps. Please.
I'm going to throw in an idea from the global health world, which is the area that I know something about. And I was talking about some of these issues with some journalists from Uganda and some public health people from Uganda and Tanzania and some other places in Africa. And they immediately got the importance of Creative Commons and of net neutrality, and of a number of different things. I mean, I hardly had to explain anything at all, because they saw that chokehold on information could keep them backward and the less powerful partner in a larger global context. And I wonder if, I mean, I think about some of the supposed values of global health, of open access to healthcare, of a lot of sharing and so forth. Is there some way to make an alliance there? Because the global health experts that I know have not yet cottoned on to Creative Commons. When they talk about making alliances with the business school to create case studies of what works and what doesn't, they don't think about whether or not those case studies are copyrighted or licensed under Creative Commons. They don't think about whether it's open software that's running their e-medical records, et cetera. So that's one possibility of it going beyond the elites in this room or similar rooms.
I was wondering, I have also a little bit of background in audience and public research kind of thing, that if you think, were you specifically talking about or proposing this whole model for people that are the jammer, so to speak, or the more general public? Because I was thinking, if you think about processes of inoculation, and isn't it exactly, if you would say that if publics become part of the machine and they have to learn how to play it, although within a Creative Commons setting, isn't it exactly that could actually lift up the whole counterculture issue that may be the start of, that they start out with? So the whole idea of their expression and creativity becomes part of the system, although it may be Creative Commons in the sense that it may be easier to express yourself. So I was wondering how from your talk, I did not get how you actually see that yourself, what this actually means for these sorts of expressions, if it becomes part of the system.
Right.
I don't know if you can answer that, actually.
If I'm not understanding the question, then put me back on course. Mm-hmm. But I think that part of the problem with some of the more oppositional strategies that I look at, that I didn't talk very much about now, but I think part of those problems is that they envision themselves as being outside, sort of throwing stones. And I find that to be not only counterproductive to what they're trying to do, but not realistic as far as, you know, where they find themselves. They constantly, so for example, Adbusters constantly finds themselves the subject of critiques by like-minded people who call them sellouts because they're now selling sneakers, you know, sweatshop-free sneakers and so on. I think it's that position, that avant-garde position of sort of being outside the machine that sets you up for all kinds of frustrations. Not the least of which is the fact that advertising itself, the thing that so many of these activists are wanting to challenge, is all about telling you that you'll be an independent, avant-garde, sort of thinking outside the box person if you buy this or that extreme product. So the kind of rebel outsider position is the most dominant trope used by advertisers. So activists constantly positioning themselves there is in some ways in the face of contemporary commercial culture, seems to be kind of playing right into the hands of, you know, of marketers. I think that the thing that's interesting, one of the many things that's interesting about the kind of more Creative Commons approach is that it has the potential, and this is, I guess, one of the things that I'm interested in people's thoughts about, at least has the potential to kind of take the wind out of the sails of the big brand giants, because it's, you know, it's not about saying no to Mickey Mouse or saying no to Barbie. It's like Barbie and Mickey Mouse is neither here nor there, right? It's just like about creating this pool that isn't dependent either in a negative or a positive way with corporate culture. But it's not one that can be said to be wholly outside it either, right? And it's not one that I think ultimately, I mean, and it's my position that any kind of, that avant-gardism in general, it doesn't serve, and I don't put Creative Commons in this camp, but avant-gardism, like
culture, like many culture jammers kind of position themselves as, is ultimately rhetorically as a social movement, as a model for social movements, a dead end. Because it so depends on a monolithic enemy that you're sort of, that you're constantly critiquing and so on. And I think that the thing that's compelling about Creative Commons is that it doesn't do that. It's not about throwing stones at a monolithic enemy. It's about creating alternatives that don't position themselves outside it, but don't wholly depend on this negative relationship to it either, at least in my estimation. So I think my goal is, or at least in the way I'm trying to think about it, is to do away with these kinds of inside-outside mainstream counterculture dichotomies anyway, because I don't think that they're really very descriptive of how things really work. Because we have culture jammers working in industry as advertisers, right? I mean, that magazine comes out of the design community, the graphic design community, and you know that we have, you know, Andy Warhol, you know, was making, you know, displays for stores, you know, that whole movement came out of, you know, marketing and advertising. So I mean, these things are so inextricably linked that I think any rhetoric that tries to presume otherwise or to pull the two things apart and to look at them as separate entities kind of misses opportunities.
So this also mean that, let's say, the creator online, just so not a critiquer, but let's say someone who does stuff on YouTube and, do the mashups and stuff, would that kind of person also fit this kind of model, do you think? Or
That's the thing is that, that's why... I find it compelling because it's not one that's dependent on the rebel position, right? It's like, oh, I'm just an artist doing, you know, using this because it makes the most sense for me to get my work out or to me to continue my work is to take advantage of the resources that are out there. That it's not to say that it takes the politics out of it. There's always going to be people who are engaging at that level, and I think that's important. Right, just as I think that the people who are fighting just for good old-fashioned fair use is important work to be done. But in addition to that, more oppositional stuff that has to be done, creating this other pool that just sort of everyday people can take advantage of seems to me important.
All right, thanks.
I'm not moderating.
Yeah, go
It sounds to me as though some of this discussion, sort of tracks discussion that's been going on inside Creative Commons, sort of, is it a movement or is it a tool that can be used by all sorts of movements?
Right.
Is it just a set of licenses that can be taken by people who agree with one another or by people who disagree? Or does it collect all of the activist causes that all of the license adopters are part of?
Right.
And I think of late it's been trying to divide those pieces out into the core of Creative Commons, the House of Licenses, and iCommons, the meeting place of like-minded activists who use the licenses and then build out projects that go in multiple directions.
Right. And I think any social movement works that way, right? Whether you call it a movement or not, right? That there's that kind of the pragmatic sort of the architecture of the thing that and those people who are kind of fighting based on ideology or values and so on. But yeah, no, I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask a question about this. You drew attention to the lyrics that Pete Townsend wrote about being part of the machine, and if I remember correctly, that's maybe halfway through the CD or the opera, and maybe two thirds of the way through the movie. And then I don't want to pretend. I think we all know that there's not an explicit policy document in Tommy, but. Maybe there is, and I'm wrong again. I'm used to that. But later on, Tommy is no longer blind, deaf, and dumb, but can see, and there's a process that creates or miraculously generates that somehow. And among other lyrics, there's also the part where he and people working with him, who also may be followers, that's debatable, say, we're not going to take it, and we never did, we never will. Right. So there's something more oppositional, and at the same time, there's a. I think it's fair to say that since Tommy can see, he can now have a broader view of. He can choose whether to be part of the machine or stand away from it and work with it as a as an agent, something like that. So anyway, does that mean anything with the within the context of what you were talking about, or is that just my
wacky adolescent musings? I mean, I have to think about that more. I think that that's good. But I mean, part of what I was trying to get at there, and maybe the metaphor works or it doesn't work, and now I'm sort of seeing the chinks in the armor of the metaphor. No, no, but I. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Does it? What does that do to the? Yeah. Well, how I was trying to think about it, and when I talk about this concept of kairos with my students, I'll often use the example of that it's the difference between, and I don't know if this works or not, but it works for me. It's the difference between American football and soccer, right? Because American football is like a coach designs a play, the actors go out onto the field and they enact the play. So the play exists a priori, the enactment of the play. Whereas soccer is much more kairotic in that it's this like a team, you know, is having to respond in the moment to like where, you know, that it's much less play oriented, that the play is much more spontaneous and kairotic and sort of you're responding to the particular conditions much more so. And I know it's not a perfect analogy, but that's what I was kind of trying to get at with that notion of pinball and sort of Tommy feeling, you know, sort of being part of it to, as an extension of himself and so on, as a better way of thinking of production than this kind of, you know, I'm here and the content is there sort of thing. But yeah, I like your interpretation of it. Maybe a limitation on that. I have to think about it.
I feel like I'm still sort of digesting this whole concept. I like the football soccer description. I think that's quite useful. I suspect that there are, I mean, as going back to the meta question that you asked, I suspect that there are lots of good answers and examples and foods for thought. And I guess my gut reaction, not feeling like I'm the best informed in this, is that there are already movements in the market afoot that are not value-based in the sense of what's the right way to do things or the wrong way to do things because it's, you know, some deeply held social idea, but rather that they're seeing a market opportunity and they're starting to realize, and this is maybe having drunk too much Kool-Aid, but I feel like there are lots of examples, whether it's in the space of innovation or anything you're seeing in kind of the digital media kind of space, right, where people are starting, or where industry is starting to realize that the drag that certain aspects of intellectual property place on using exactly and creating right and stuff is greater than the benefit that it gives. Now, I mean, it's definitely slow in coming, and look no further than the RIAA to say that it's not, you know, right, it's not pervasive right by any stretch, but I think there are lots of examples where you're starting to see it. And my suspicion is that you see Creative Commons fighting in its way and its community and making its points, but that the existing system is going to move quickly to kind of co-opt and to retain its mode of production. And, you know, and if it's smart, and maybe certain entities within it will be smart, they'll recognize these new opportunities to create, to produce and information, ideas, and cultural products and more. And that it will retain this ecosystem. I was just talking to one of our faculty directors, John Dayton, the other day. He was talking about how when companies think about marketing now, and they think about putting a video or something out into the world, it's not a question of whether they will get ridiculed and get spoofed. It's a question of how they'll get spoofed.
Yeah, yeah.
And how can they get spoofed in the right way as opposed to the wrong way. And so it's very much become part of how they see their, as you know, they're turning over this aspect of the marketing, and they're trying to direct it in a certain way so that it makes them look kind of fun and cool,
right,
albeit the butt of the joke,
right,
which I thought was terrifically interesting.
No, that is really interesting. And I guess
about, you know, that certain corporations are sort of starting to, we were talking about this a little bit last night at the Free Culture group meeting, that that certain companies are seeing that it just makes more sense to take that leap of faith and to kind of, you know, allow for broader collaboration, to have a little bit of a less of a proprietary, you know, claim on their content and so on. And I mean, it seems like, again, people in this room are going to know much more about this than I do, but I mean, it seems like when it comes to code and source stuff, then companies seem to kind of get that it's in some ways more efficient to allow people to collaborate and so on. But I guess the question then becomes, what about when you're talking about content? It isn't valued based on efficiency, right? That you're not trying to solve problems with a film or a song in the same kind of way. You know, you could argue that you are, but in the same kind of way as you are just with a piece of software. So where is the, you know, the incentive for more mainstream groups that don't necessarily care about the ideological, you know, it's more democratic or any of that, right? That's not necessarily the interest. How do you show that it is a good avenue? I guess that's part of my question, that content isn't driven by efficiency in the same kind of way.
By your notion of the fact that there's not necessarily an opposition between the more public space of operation and the traditional market kind of space. As I think about it, the opposition really comes when people try and move from maybe one domain to the other. Because although we all know little bits and pieces of exception, by and large, most people operate within their kind of daily personal sphere as though copyright didn't exist. I mean, I certainly do. You know, everybody operates with it in that way, and you quote from books, and you send it to your friend, and you write fan magazine things, and you know, takeoffs, and you post them on small websites and all that. And we just operate, in fact, quite as though it's irrelevant. And every now and then, some thunderbolt comes out of Zeus, and we strike somebody dead. But mostly, you know, people just don't pay attention. And it's really only when you move into either some kind of very public oppositional role or into that sphere yourself that suddenly the gods of copyright take notice of you, and then you have to deal with it. So I see this kind of bubbling level of the informal publics, if I can use that term not too badly, where it's not a question. And then you get to the more formal levels or the more commercially oriented. It's only when you really either want to oppose or be part of that the commercial interests kind of come down on you. Is that too
And it seems like companies are increasingly, you know, trying to really choose their battles around a lot of this stuff, because sometimes it behooves them to go after copyright infringers. Other times it doesn't, right? Other times it's just plain bad PR. I mean, I think Mattel found themselves in a lot of trouble in the 90s with going after fan sites and these kinds of things, right? That I think that this, obviously, the smarter companies get that you want people to have their fan sites. You don't want to be going after, you know, that sort of thing, that that you can really hurt yourself in the long run by letting things come out in this kind of David and Goliath way. I guess part of the question too is that one difference, I mean, I don't want to suggest that there are no differences between markets and publics, whatever that means. I just want to suggest that they're not these separate entities either. You know, one of the differences seems to be that, you know, the difference between, I guess, an artist and a content provider, you know, whatever that doesn't might be, is that one is usually in it for profit, right? That there's profit is sort of the goal, whereas for a lot of people, I think, who are wanting to take advantage of, you know, Creative Commons and other means, is, you know, that the goal can be all kinds of things. It can be the, you know, reputation. It can be, you know, getting the pride of getting your work out there. It can be earning, you know, certain like credibility among your community. It can be, you know, there's all kinds of things that drive, you know, I mean, people are driven to create all the time. And so it's interesting to see if, I mean, I don't know if something gets lost as corporations just adopt, you know, if they adopt kind of Creative Commons style licenses, if that does anything instrumentally to undermine the sort of profit-only model we seem to have in terms of cultural production, but I don't know.
Any final words, thoughts, reflections? Well, in that case, please join me in thanking you.
Thank you.